Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Hazen Jihu. It is my pleasure to introduce Chef Tyler Florence, author of Inside the Test Kitchen, 120 New Recipes Perfected. After graduating from the culinary program at Johnson & Wales University, Tyler began honing his skills in New York, where he quickly emerged to be one of the finest young stars. He is a veteran of the Food Network, recently starring in The Great Food Truck Race and Worst Cooks in America. Along with his award-winning restaurant, the Wayfair Tavern in San Francisco, and El Paseo Chop House in Mill Valley, Tyler owns his own retail shop, also located in Mill Valley. He has a signature line of cookware and cutlery at Williams-Sonoma, as well as a line of organic baby food called Sprout, and a California wine label called California Crush. Tyler is the author of 12 best-selling cookbooks, and most recently received another James Beard nomination in the Best Chef West category. Moderating this evening's program is Paolo Lucchesi, inside scoop columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tyler Florence, Paolo Lucchesi.
Good to see you guys. How you doing? We got to say hello to my good friend Paolo Lucchesi from the San Francisco Chronicle. Say hi. What a nice crowd.
Yeah, thank you everyone for coming.
Santa Clara.
Yeah.
How you feeling? Right on. I love it. Good to see you guys.
Yeah, thank you.
How many people have been to Wayfair? Fantastic. How many people haven't been to Wayfair? So we haven't fed everybody in the Bay Area yet.
So I got to ask, let's start here. Like, why did you come out to the Bay Area from New York?
Well, thank you for that, by the way. When I'm home and I'm not traveling, I try to eat my restaurants every single day, right? Because I think it's what you do every day that really counts, right? And, being in this sort of this right place at the right time, because I don't think I could replicate my success if I had to do it over again. It's a different world now, right? I always consider that I just think I'm the luckiest man on the face of the planet. Not that, luck supersedes hard work, because I feel like, the harder we work, the more opportunities happen for us. I don't believe in luck. But when we decided to move to California, I felt that we were ready to make a big jump, right? I think life is more interesting when you actually take these chances that feel somewhat dangerous, right? So I think every 10 years or so, you should do something that really kind of scares you, right? I mean, so I lived in New York City for when I graduated from college in 1993. I got a culinary degree from Johnson & Wales University, and then I got a bachelor's degree in hotel restaurant management. And in 2005, they gave me an honorary doctorate, which I was very proud of. But I was in New York City, and I met my wife. And then we're pregnant, and we're trying to figure out what we wanted to do. And at that point, I was in New York City from, 1993, 94, up until 2005, 2006. And, I lived in Brooklyn for a long time, which I loved. My oldest son was born in Brooklyn. And then we were expecting our first child together. And she... I was having a glass of wine. She was having a water, but she was saying what's it about New York? Why do you just love New York so much? And it was just kind of like one of those things, like when people say like, where'd you grow up, right? Like I was born in South Carolina and I was raised in South Carolina, but I grew up in New York City, right? So, coming straight out of college and just being a college campus, and a lot of people remember kind of what stepping out of college for the first time was like. You really don't know anything. You've had a little bit of experience and you've got some work ethic under your belt, but you don't know anything. And I just felt like my edge and my drive, my curiosity, my work ethic came out of having to survive in New York City. Like, I moved to New York City straight out of college, and I grew up really poor. My parents didn't really have a lot of money. It was sort of lower middle class, and when I was in college, my parents gave me nothing, right? So, I mean, there was like moments where I would have to literally go to a blood bank and have my plasma pulled, and I would sell my plasma for money to put in my. This is real, you know, like. So when life became interesting, you know, like working in New York City, I never took it lightly, not for a second, right? So I moved to New York City straight out of college, and I worked with Charlie Palmer at Oriel for a year and a half between Oriel and another restaurant he had called the Chef's Cuisinier Club. And then I kind of bounced around from place to place and ended up my first appearance on Food Network in 1996. And so everything I had worked towards and took my life so incredibly seriously, being in college and knew I came from nothing. Like, I think in a way the best thing my dad ever did for me was give me nothing. Not that he did on purpose. He just didn't have anything to give, right? Because what that gave me was this sense of drive. Like, I have no one else to rely on but myself and my own wit and my hard work and determination, my refusal to take no for an answer, right? So in that wonderful period of blowing up on Food Network and kind of being a part of that initial wave, like, so I started in 1996 and Food Network started in 1993. So they were 3 years old when I started, and I was 25 years old, and we just went along for the ride. I just closed my eyes and I jumped and I just leapt into this abyss because I was a trained restaurant chef and was doing that very successfully in New York City. But I said to myself, if I don't do this, I'll never know what that's like. And the door will close, the window will close. They'll find somebody else for the thing. And I'll have to do this for the rest of my life. So the interesting thing about it, when I moved to California December 2006, most of the world had only really known, especially on a national level, just my sort of kind of what we did on television, right? And what we did on television, what we still do on television, is speak a very specific language, right? So kind of walking into a new market, a new territory, and a new city, with the idea of not, you know, we're gonna show you guys what's what, and we're gonna put our flag in the ground. There's a new chef in town or whatever. That wasn't the position. We wanted to kind of come in town and let everybody know that we're incredibly serious about this, right? So to answer your question, like we moved to California just because it felt good. Right. My wife is from Marin County, right? I always think you have something fun to talk about when you do fun things, right? And when you have an interesting point of view, just because you do things that are like sometimes without reason, right? It was probably my third attempt to move to California anyway, just because there was some sort of magnetic pull that I love the West Coast. And when I got here, I realized, although I'm from the South, that I had been cooking California food my entire life, but didn't really know it until I got to California. So to answer your question in a very long-winded, roundabout kind of way, like, we moved here because it felt right. And that's sort of how we take every day. Does it feel good?
Yeah. And yet, even beyond the restaurants, you've pursued so many different avenues for your business. It's not only... the reason we're here is the book, the Test Kitchen book, and you kind of rethink a lot of these classic recipes, and I can't help but make that parallel to your career. You've kind of redefined what a chef is as a businessman. You're doing all these different things, and, you know, can you kind of speak about why you pursue all these various avenues and why you make the choices you do in your career?
Like, I don't know. Why do we all make the choices we do? I don't... I feel like I'm being chased by a tiger, right? I feel like I work because not only I love what I do, but I feel like if I don't get it out of my head and into some sort of wave of production, that it haunts me like a ghost, right? Like it's something like living with regret because you have an idea that you think, oh my God, wouldn't it be great? And you know you all have one, right? That idea that when you're in the shower or you're driving the car and you think through what that thing is, right? I have developed a discipline of getting that out of my head and into a trusted document that we go back and we review, and we get into this discipline of buying the domain name right away, starting the trademark process, and then sort of sussing out, is it the right time to explore this opportunity, or is it just a good idea? And if it's just a good idea, we shelf it. And 9 times out of 10, that idea will become relevant within 2 years. Like, we'll be at a meeting, and Samet would say, you know, what would be great if we had this thing, would it fit this? I'm like, bang, boom. We already did it, right? So I don't know what necessarily pulls me, and I don't really question it, right? And I don't have a fear that I won't be successful, because I've kind of given myself over to the process of just letting your creative opportunities sort of take over in a way, right? Like, if you really believe that this thing is going to be this thing, right? Like, I own 8 companies, right? And we're launching 2 tech businesses this year. Like, we're going to redefine food tech and it's like this new food buzz. It's like this buzz thing, this new category that all the venture capitalists are sort of like diving into in a big way. And we're gonna redefine that genre before it's even something, right? That I feel like it would be my worst regret in life to not do something, or at least try something, that I was crazy about, right? So it's just sort of kind of getting this discipline thing. So why do I make the decisions I do? I just, when the idea hits me, right? And 2 of my business partners in the front row here, and I'm sure it's just, I can't imagine what being on that side of the conversation is like. You must think I'm crazy. Like, a little bit, right? Like, okay. But the interesting thing about it, like, we'll just be in a conversation, something will happen, and somebody will say something. I'm like, did you say that? Right? So we make decisions based on our creative flow, right? And then as a company, based on the experience of we have, you know, sort of inventing concepts, and that's, you know, restaurants and airport stuff and wine and retail and things like that, like, do we have time, right? Is it viable? Because not everything makes a cut. And is it something that we're really passionate about?
I think I want to know, what are some of your failed ideas?
Failed ideas?
Failed ideas that you're like, you're pursuing this idea, and then you just turn around one day and it's like, or you look back 5 years later, it's like, what was I thinking?
Sometimes it's not, like, you know, and sometimes I get a little bitter about it. It's not so what was I thinking. I'm like, what do they know, right? you know what I mean? What do they know? How come you don't like this idea? So we rotisserie and wine, for example, right? Yeah. That would be sort of our failure. And sometimes I'm not afraid to fail, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not afraid to fail. And I'm not really afraid to fail in front of people, because yeah. Like, I think sometimes our failures are greater than some people's attempts just to not do anything, right? Mm-hmm. And I just think, like, if you don't keep pushing it, right, you'll never know what you're capable of. And sometimes it's nice to live in a world where you don't know what you can't not do, right? So we opened up a restaurant in downtown Napa called Rotisserie and Wine, and it was we got hooked into this the revitalization of downtown Napa, right? And if Julia Child, right, and Robert Mondavi, and $80 million and this like wine center thing couldn't attract a crowd of people, what am I going to do? I mean, you know what I mean? At the end of the day, right? So Morimoto and I, his former business manager, Mark Stone, and I, we met a couple of times. And we said, listen, I'll do it if you'll do it, right? He wouldn't go if I didn't do it, and I wouldn't go unless he did it. So at least we sort of moved in as like a position, right? And Morimoto blew up right? And it was, you know, because it's the only restaurant on the West Coast of the United States, and it's amazing, and it's kind of like a nightclub in downtown Napa, and it's fun. And our little chicken shop failed in a year, right? So we kind of walked in, no money down, but then walked out about $500,000 in debt. And it happened so fast. It happened so incredibly fast. And it was just kind of like one of those things. And I mean, Donna and I went up there like on this, like, you know, because we wanted to give it a year, right? So it was a year and a day. And Donna and I had this really sad drive up to Napa with the keys and had to explain to our staff that we're going to wrap it up. And I don't take that kind of thing very, I don't take it lightly. But what I do take it seriously, right? Because I think when you if you have a success story, I think it's you have to really track those successes. And I think if you have a failure, I think you have to track the failures with the same reverence, right? Because there's life lessons in all of that, right? Because if and so the next time that you step up to the plate, right, your the walls of your castle are higher. And your moats are deeper, and you've got a better team, and you know what to look for, and you can smell crazy a mile away, and you know not to let in your circle, and so it just becomes a thing where you learn and you grow from that, right? Because I mean, like sometimes you know you can't fast track. I was telling my 18-year-old son this, right? Because you can't fast track experience as much as you want to. You can't fast track experience. You can bite off more than you can chew and then figure it out as you go, right? But you can't fast track the process, right? So failures, I mean, you know, we get told no from time to time with ideas, but then we come back and we refine them, right? And we come back even stronger and harder with something they can't say no to, right? So it's just sort of a process.
What is success to you?
Well, I mean, I don't tell anybody. I have no idea what I'm doing. Yeah. Don't tell anybody. But we I don't know. I don't really know what success is. But if I died tomorrow, I would feel like I've had a very successful life, right? I would feel like, I mean, this gentleman, he's very successful. Look at that. He's giving me a bunch of cards, right? I feel like the opportunity to be successful happens without it takes so much planning and organizing to be successful that it doesn't happen by accident, right? And the more you can control that, the more successful you'll be, right? Like I don't believe in luck, right? Like luck is for suckers, right? Luck is random, right? Luck is like you winning the lottery, right? But success is discipline, right? Success is drive and determination. Success is not taking no for an answer ever, 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 right? But when you get to that specific place where you've sort of talked your way into this opportunity, right? You have to deliver it. Like sometimes you get there and it's like the dog that caught the car, right? Okay, now what, right? But when you get there, it's easy to come up. It's really hard to stay there, right? And when you get to that specific situation, like then you've been given the successful opportunity, right? That could be permanent or could be fleeting, and it's up to you to blow, right? So I don't know if I know what success is, just because I don't know if I've really felt it. But I feel successful, and I feel like we put ourselves in a successful situation to be successful. I don't know what success is, right? I think I'm happy for sure. I'm happy. Like I love life. Life is great. But I think success is always that thing you can't quite touch, and I think that's a healthy thing.
This person wants to pursue a career in culinary arts, freshman in college. Is culinary school necessary for a career in culinary arts? If so, how beneficial is going to culinary school versus not?
I'm having that same conversation with my 18-year-old son right now because he is elected to not go to college, right? It's not a bad thing to think about, to be very specifically honest with you. There are a lot of smart people that are writing very compelling stories and articles on the relevance of university life. If you're not exactly sure what you're going for, right? A lot of people are saying it's camp for 18-year-olds, right? Right? I mean, think about that, right? You go to a dorm, you get to wear flip-flops and shorts all day. You know, your priorities are your own. It may not be the best use of your parents' money, right? You know, it may not be the best thing for everybody. So my son is really into tech, right? He's 18 years old, just got out of high school. And he was like, "Dad, listen, the phone that you're using right now was developed 2 years ago, right? If I go to college right now and study what I'm passionate about, I will be learning 5 to 10-year-old theory and technology, right? If I get out in the marketplace right now and I start working in the industry, I will be working with the absolute cutting edge product and be there when it changes, right? And I can't say he's wrong, right? So at the end of the day, right, we all, you know, and I'm not making this up, right? You just take a look at new job opportunities for college grads, and I'm speaking to you college grads, right? That people walk out with a 4-year degree and they want to be relevant in the marketplace, but they realize that this situation has given them some personal life lessons and experiences and stories and things they can talk about, right? But it hasn't really given them a leg up in the industry that they want to get into, right? So the question is, right, kind of going back to this, you know, turn of the century sort of immigrant philosophy, right, is the apprenticeship thing the way to go, right? If you hop into a situation where you can learn from somebody who's on the ground in the arena, as Teddy Roosevelt would put it, right, in the arena, right, living it on a daily basis, and you're there absorbing it like a sponge, right, and you're doing it in this benign kind of way that it doesn't cost your parents a penny, right, and if you want to flake out and change your mind, you know what I mean, like you didn't have to get a second mortgage on your house to make that strange life decision for your child, right? That I think it's kind of healthy, right? So our plan is right now, again, take it a year at a time. If he wants to change his mind and go to college, I'll be there to support him. But right now, I'm kind of interested in what he's interested in. He's bussing tables at Wayfair Tavern, right? So I think that's good, right? He's seeing where his dad, you know, how hard his dad works, right? And then also, and he just got an internship at a tech company in San Francisco, right? That's about 5 blocks away from the restaurant, right? So I think that's our thing. To make that relevant back to the question, there's no two ways about it, right? There's no one way about it, right? Like, I went to culinary school, and I don't know what I got out of it, to be perfectly honest with you, right? I mean, Johnson & Wales University is a great university. It's a great campus. It's a great institution in Providence, Rhode Island, right? I went to their Charleston, South Carolina campus that was about 10 to 12 years old when I went there, and it was originally constructed as a naval university outpost to teach naval cadets how to cook. It wasn't designed to, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? But it wasn't like if you analyze the Charleston experience, right, and you analyze the Providence experience, you'd have a hard time saying the 2 degrees were the same thing, right? So I don't know what I got out of it specifically, right? As a matter of fact, when I got out of it, like I had this argument with one of the instructors because I felt like you're going to send me out in the marketplace right now, and that's the best you can do, right? Like, with tech books that are 15 years old, talking about ancient Balkan cuisine, and are like, are you kidding me? And this is like the era of like Charlie Palmer and Alfred Portale and like New York City. I went from Charleston straight to New York City, and you know, like, obviously green as a plantain, but moving into like the hottest restaurant scene in the world at the time, right? And I felt wildly unprepared for the situation. So if you had to translate that into moving into this apprenticeship type of philosophy, I think it should be open for debate. And I think parents should sort of have, you know, an open-mindedness about a child choosing to not necessarily pursue a college life if that's what you really want to do, right? Because, like, I walked out of college, God, $75,000 in debt, right? It took me 10 years to pay it off, right? I remember writing like when I got one of my first like Food Network checks, I paid off my student loans like $30,000, dropped it in the mail, right? But to me, like I don't regret a second of it, right? And I feel like in a way, like Charleston, South Carolina really taught me how to cook more than necessarily the institution, but I wouldn't have been there if it wasn't for the school, so you can't really say what's relevant, what's not relevant, right? But the idea of like going to culinary school, I still think you have to take your career seriously. I think you have to, so whoever you are, I would say watch Ratatouille, right? Which is the best food film ever made. Ever. Be Linguini, right? Take your knife bag and go knock on a Michelin 3-star restaurant in Paris and go wash dishes, right? And start there. That's what I would do. You'll get more out of it. That's my point. We got a round of applause and that was good. That was the first question.
After hosting a few seasons of Food Truck Race, do you think the food truck craze continues? Do you think it will evolve further?
It feels sort of, you know, big to say, right? Because the genre of food trucks have expanded so much, right? But when we started the Great Food Truck Race season one, we finished season one, right? And I was doing PR for the show, right? I did the Today Show, we did Good Morning America, I did, you know, satellite media tours and radio media tours and talked to everybody I possibly can about what the show was. Nobody got it. Nobody understood it. And everybody had the same thing. Like, are you kidding me? You mean those roach coaches out by the construction site, right? There's no way I'm going to eat off one of those. Like, what are you talking about? That's disgusting, right? I'm like, no. You really don't understand, right? So you can't have order without chaos, right? So the food truck revolution began out of the economic crisis and the economic crash of 2008, right? So when disposable income dries up, restaurants are the first thing that gets caught out of someone's budget, right? And when restaurants don't have patrons, restaurants go out of business. And chefs lose their job. And chefs, like myself, technically, were kind of one-trick ponies, right? And we have to practice our craft someplace, right? So there was a shift in what it meant to open a restaurant, right? So we were noticing these pockets, this trending pocket of like in Portland and in Los Angeles, right? And in New York, right? And in Austin, Texas, right? Where chefs were electing to get behind four wheels instead of behind four walls, right? Because like, as I mean, listen, I'm famous. Raising money is as a pain in the butt. I mean, the death rate of a restaurant. 9 out of 10 restaurants die before the second birthday. That's real, right? Trying to raise like $2.3 million, $4 million, right, to open up a restaurant. That's real, and that's hard to raise, right? But if you're crafty about it, right, like thinking through what being an independent operator means, right. Having low overhead, having flexibility, right? Being where the people are, and not having the anchor of a brick and mortar address is the ultimate success story for a restaurant, because you don't have to stand there hat in hand and beg people to come to you. You can be where they are, right? You can be in 3 or 4 different locations in a week, right? So where we started with the Great Food Truck Race, and I try not to like be too sort of boisterous about this, because I don't know if it would have happened in its own evolution process anyway, or if we gassed it and made it popular. I feel like on one way or another we contributed at a really, really high level with the success of what the genre is, right? I feel like we really did, right? And the people that are doing it well are putting 6 figures a year in their pocket, $100,000, right? Making like tacos and grilled cheese sandwiches and stuff like that, because you know why? They have very limited overhead, very small staff. They have a dedicated loyal following. They spend nothing in marketing, Twitter, Instagram, thank you, right? And it's mostly cash business, right? And they can open up when they want to open and close when they close, and close when they close. So your success story is kind of on your own. A lot of food trucks fail too, right? But the ones that make it are great, right? And they become these sort of success stories in the community, right? So I think the next evolution in the genre, because everybody's buying into it, right? And it's not just like you see food trucks on the street. Like there are food truck carnivals and food truck fairs and food truck nights. And like cities, civic areas are saying, let's get all the food trucks together. Let's call them up and let's string some lights and we'll get a band and, you know, and get a beer truck and call it a party and it'll be blah, blah, blah. It's like instant festival, right? And it's fun. So I don't think it's going anywhere, right? And what I like about it the most, because it and a lot of communities, right? It's sort of dangerous, right? Because community areas, right, like downtown business districts, are banding together, and contacting their district representatives, and creating these business blocks. By saying food trucks can't come in our community, right? And I think it's anti-capitalistic, right? I think it's anti-business. And if a taco truck is intimidating to your own business model, you should look internally, right? And say, why is Koji Taco like really, really scaring me, right? Why are all these people lined up to buy a taco when they're not coming to my restaurant, right? And it's just sort of like the evolution of everything, right? So it's the new subgenre of restaurants that I feel like we've contributed to at a really, really high level. I'm proud of our work. I'm really proud of our work. The Great Food Truck Race Season 6 starts off in about 4 weeks, which I'm very excited about, right? We're going from Los Angeles to Alaska. I get Anchorage and I get Vancouver. I don't really know what we're going to do in between. I don't really know.
Maybe some whales?
Maybe some whales. Bears, maybe some moose.
Maybe. Yeah.
I don't really know. But I'm really excited about our hard, good work that we put into that show. So thank you for asking a question.
A follow-up on that from me, because, you know, I think food trucks, and I see it in San Francisco, you know, it's also, in addition to everything you said, I agree with everything, it's also, you know, they're attracting a lot of young chefs, ambitious young chefs, and it kind of is another avenue for those young chefs. And, you know, what are your thoughts on, I mean, you have two restaurants in the Bay Area. I'm guessing you have heard the things within the industry that there's a drastic young cook shortage. Mm-hmm. In the city, and you know, you say that, you know, that young cooks should put your head down, and I think a lot of people would agree with that. But at the same time, the city's an expensive place to live at. It's a hard industry, as you know. And I mean, how do you, you know, there's so many other avenues for a young chef in 2015. There's food trucks. There's tech cafeterias. There's this. There's that. I mean, what do you tell your young cooks that are working at Wayfair, for example?
Right. So when I was coming up in restaurants, like food came from a hole in the wall, and nobody really cared who the chef was, right? Nobody really understood. It wasn't a big deal, right? And until I started working for Charlie Palmer in New York and really understood what that mega chef like following was all about, right? But today. There's so many different wonderful avenues that can be pursued, and the idea of like the chef becoming the celebrity chef, becoming the celebrity blogger, right? Becoming the celebrity blogger, cookbook writer, some of the YouTube sensation, right? Like I think it's all amazing, right? So as long as you feel like you can make money at what you're doing, right, and you can live up to your own like personal financial responsibilities and take care of your wife and your kid and your car payment, whatever it is, like, I think if you want to reinvent the genre and kind of come up with new things, I think that's kind of cool. I do on the other side of it, I do think that there's like a millennial. You know, and who knows, like if Zuckerberg makes all this kind of thing happen, but everybody feels like they want to be both rich and famous in 5 minutes, right? And everybody feels like as soon as they get involved in the company, like where's my profit sharing? Like where's everything? And in a way, like it's the And we treat our associates with the utmost respect, and we have a very, very competitive employment strategy, and I love my guys to death. But the idea of that it's easy, right, or it's quick, right, is painfully misleading. It really, really is, right? So it's when you fake it or you lie about it or you say that your Instagram account or your Twitter followers are enough to propel you, or you win a reality cooking show, right? Like these things, and I host a few of them, and I'm always really blunt with them, and not in a negative way. I try to be supportive as possible, right? But sometimes these kids get out of these situations, they really think they're famous, right? And they are, right? For 5 seconds, it's a very like highly metabolized kind of entertainment society we live in. Very highly metabolized, right? Right? What's next, right? But if you really think through who is famous for a long time, right? And so that fame is sustainable, right? It's not because you're popular or you have a catchphrase or you're witty in a way. It's a deeper it factor inside of that situation, right? That you can't fake, right? When you're standing in front of a camera and you're cooking a recipe, you have to look at those ingredients. You have to know that recipe by heart. You have to have 25 years of experience under your belt to be able to talk about these things at depth, right? And even if you're just getting started in that particular situation, right? Like, there's such a thin veneer, right, of people that they sort of get up and give it a shot. And I want everybody to give it a try. Trust me, 25 years ago, or 20 years ago when I started on Food Network, I was horrible, right? And I think everybody's got to start someplace. But, you know, overnight success is not overnight success. Overnight success is 15 years, right? Minimum, right? And unless you're interested in going for the long haul, to answer your question, like, I think young cooks, right? Like, I shot my last cookbook on an iPad, right? Because the technology is amazing, and technology's there, right? And so 3 or 4 years ago, the resolution on those things weren't good enough to print, but now all of a sudden they are, right? So this technology that you have in your camera, right, has a higher resolution than some of the satellites that are taking pictures of planets up in space because they were launched so long ago, right? I mean, think about that, right? The camera that you have in your pocket has a higher resolution than NASA's satellites around space, right? So yeah, of course you can print. If you can shoot Instagram pictures, you can shoot a great cookbook, right? So we're in this sort of rapidly expanding, like the technology and like the information, the way it rolls quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker, right? And the young chefs, and I'm sorry if I'm just waxing on about nothing right now, but the young chefs that are out there are becoming so good, right? The chefs that are in their like late 20s and early 30s right now are the best thing that America has ever seen in the history of food and restaurants, right? And that's all because of social media, right? Right? Because when I was growing up, right, like if you wanted to absorb the Thomas Keller experience, right, you had to fly to San Francisco, drive to Napa, get a hotel room, get a reservation, go sit there, eat for 6 hours, take pictures, write it down, bring it back. And now you could see what these places post for specials every night, right? So this process is being decoded at such a rapid pace that the quality of the cooks in America are phenomenal, right? So I don't know if there's any right way to do it. And to answer your question, you're right. San Francisco is a very expensive city to live in, right? And I think what will probably have to happen, right, and this is just a factor of life, is food, right, and the experience of food will have to adjust itself for inflation, right? Because top line cures all ills, right? If we want to live in a society that has fantastic restaurants, right? Guess what? It's probably going to cost you more than a $20 bill to eat dinner, right? It might cost you two $20 bills, right? To eat dinner, if you really think about it, right? So I think the new metric for what consumption is all about in society is a Starbucks cup of coffee, right? So if you're willing to pay $5.20 or $5 or $4.75 or whatever it is for that cappuccino or latte, right? And I do that every day, sometimes twice a day, right? Can you imagine walking to a restaurant and actually thinking you could get out of there with top-notch, organic, well-sourced ingredients cooked by a professional for less than $20, less than $40, right? I mean, think about it, right? It sounds expensive, but what's expensive? Not having these restaurants, right? Because there's certain if there was an adjustment for inflation, and I'm just giving you the hard facts because I'm a businessman, right? If there was an adjustment for inflation, right, that we could actually pay not just what the mandated minimum wage is plus a competitive salary, right? But if we could actually pay something that people could afford to live, really, really live, right? Like, you're going to get a much, much better, much healthier culinary environment that we can all live in and all celebrate, right? So there's no easy answer to it, right? But, you know, it's definitely a responsibility that we all have to share. We all have to share, unfortunately. On a simple level, one thing I thought was really inspiring was like risotto, right? So we took a little poll in the office, right? And everybody, you know, like who likes to make risotto? And nobody likes to make risotto, right? How many people make risotto at home, right? Right? How many people like risotto, right? Very, very different answer, right? So when you make risotto at home, right? The only thing people can possibly think of is I got to stand over this like plate of rice and I got to stir and I don't understand it, right? I mean, is it like a pilaf? Is it like, is it like Uncle Ben's? Like. And I'm not joking. Like some people, like it's like a thing, right? It's like a unicorn, right? So then you have to kind of get into the super basics, right? And not in a pedestrian kind of way, but really kind of walk it through. Like there's a bunch of different kinds of rice, right? They all come from the Vento and part of Italy, the sort of like the bread basket, right? There's like Via Lignano and Arborio and a bunch of other different kind of grains, and they all kind of give you sort of a different experience. But the labor is still the same, right? So you mince an onion, and you throw it into a pot. It's 50-50 olive oil and butter. You saute that till it's almost kind of sweet, and you pull the sugar out. You throw in the rice, you give it a good stir, toast it, if you will, right? And then you add a splash of white wine, which in theory kind of releases the exterior starch coating. And then you start to kind of mount the stock in one ladle at a time, right? And then you ladle in, you stir and it absorbs it, and you ladle in, you stir it and absorb it. And then you get to this thing where the rice gets kind of overly activated, and there's a fine moment where it's perfect, and then it starts to dry out again, even if you've added all the stock, right? So to me, it just seemed like untested alchemy in a way, right? Like if I know that there's a 3-to-1 ratio between stock and the rice, why can't you just add all the stock at one time? Like what would really happen? Would the sun not come up? Like, and so now I was talking to Michael Simon about this, right? I'm like, Michael, we were playing around with this risotto recipe where he just added all the stock at one time and he put his fingers in it and he goes, la, 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 la. I'm like, no, listen to me, right? Like this is where I think like the world of cooking needs to evolve, right? The way the rest of the world is evolving. We need to question these things and challenge these things because it gets in the way, right? It's not respectful of your time, it's not respectful of the ingredient, and if you can't get it right and it bums you out, you'll never make it again, and then what's the fun in that, right? So starting from scratch, so it's minced onion, 50-50 olive oil and butter, Arborio, splash of white wine, give it a good stir, and the 3-to-1 stock ratio was had, you know, like stock just off the simmer, and we added it all at one time, gave it a good stir, and turned it down, and step back and just go, okay, what's going to happen, right? So the traditional risotto recipe, right, one ladle at a time takes 42 minutes to make, right, 42 minutes, and what do you have at the end of that? We got rice. Maybe some, and it's nothing, it's not like a fancy risotto dish, right? We didn't put mushrooms in it or truffle or asparagus puree or whatever, right? Rice and Parmesan cheese, right? But when you added all the stock at one time, a couple of very interesting things happen to answer your question, right? Because it's not boiling, it's simmering, it self-agitates, so you don't have to stir it. That's interesting, right? Because all the stock has contact time with the rice all at one time, the rice actually tastes better, right? Right, we know where in risotto when you stir it, like some grains will be perfectly cooked and some grains will be slightly undercooked and some grains will be slightly overcooked. This cooks evenly, right? And we got the cook time down from 42 minutes to 27 minutes, right? And it was identical, right? And it was perfect. So I think the discoveries of kind of jumping into the kitchens, even the turkey that we came up with, right? And this is how, like, I think we're really onto something fantastic, right? So the spatchcock turkey that we kind of came out with last Thanksgiving was the turkey that everybody paid attention to in 2014, right? Because thank you very much, right? Everybody just knows what I'm talking about. And I didn't invent spatchcock, but nobody had really taken a look at a 16-pound bird and figured, okay, like, what's the real problem here, right? Right? The real problem is putting a 16-pound bird that might be a little frozen in the center when you throw it in the oven in any way as a flawed concept to begin with, right? It's just a flawed concept, right? So these waves of energy, this heat energy, has to penetrate through an inch and a half of turkey to get to the bones, right? And everyone's so incredibly nervous, rightfully so, about serving turkey that's pink at the bone or could be slightly undercooked, right? Terrified of getting somebody sick, right? So the traditional conversation is putting an insert thermometer in the thickest part of the joint, right? And when that reads like 165 to 170, you're in great shape, take it out. It's cooked, right? But let me tell you what's actually happened. You've destroyed the meat, right? And what you've done is you've cooked the bones, right? So then you leave it out for a little bit, you carve the turkey off, the bones are perfectly cooked, they go in the garbage can, you got this turkey, it's dried out, and you're like, oh. Because you get one shot a year at you know what I mean? It's not like Thursday night you're going to be whipping out a turkey for the family, you know what I mean? But every year, like, oh, why did I screw it up again, right? And then every year, there's like this trendy new thing of, hey, how many like videos from some guy in Alabama have we seen burn his house down by deep frying one, right? Always funny. Always good. Always good. The New York Times did a version for that. Bon Appetit magazine put it on the cover. And the San Francisco Chronicle put it on the cover of their food section. It's the turkey, right? And that's just Eric and I just going, okay, what do you want to do today, right? And I love it, right? Because everything we do, because I think innovations are not going, okay, let me reinvent something for the sake of it. I don't think that's the point, right? I think it's sort of addressing sort of like, it's like inventive troubleshooting, right? So where do people sort of fall off the cooking, you know, I philosophy, right? I hate it when this happens. I actually think a grilled cheese sandwich is a complicated dish to make, right? Making two grilled cheese sandwiches at the same time in a 12-inch pan, it's impossible, right? And nobody really has like slices of cheese is like this big bag of stuff, and nobody really pre-thinks the idea of like leaving butter out at room temperature, so trying to smear cold butter on soft bread and they tear it, right? You know what I'm talking about? That's the reason that the grilled cheese food trucks are so popular, because like, oh my God, now that's a grilled cheese sandwich, right? But it's really like we want to create these things that the country pays attention to. We want to create food concepts that the New York Times writes about, that Bon Appetit puts on the cover of their magazine, that we get knocked off 25 ways to Sunday, because that's why I feel like we're doing some good work. You know, it's great. So we're on a roll here, and I'm happy with it.
All right, lightning round.
Because I'm waiting for traffic to die to actually kind of get back. Because if I could wait 45 more minutes.
Will you open something in Silicon Valley?
You know, I would, can I tell you, I would absolutely, absolutely love to, right? So it's got to be like when something becomes, because there's a couple of good restaurants in here, but like when, you know, if Wolfgang Puck opened a restaurant in Palo Alto, whenever he had Spago here, and then it closes, like to me, like I kind of sense red flags in a way, like it's not right yet. It's not right yet for some crazy reason. But I think, Can I tell you how proud I am of the area that is the Silicon Valley to San Francisco? How proud I am! Like our innovative, entrepreneurial spirit is pulling the company and the country and the world out of an economic recession, right? Like the innovative work that's happening in this area now, bar none, is the most exciting thing that's happening in the world, right? And I'm very excited about it. Could I open a restaurant here? I would love to, right? Let's talk about it.
One small change for my family to eat better or healthier.
Cut the sugar out. Right. That's the one thing. Like, if you just cut like anything. If you just open up your pantry, right, and go, okay, there's sugar in all this stuff, and just get rid of it, right. I think something you could really do for that's super healthy for yourself is get a full panel spectrum blood work done on yourself and become citizen scientists on yourself, right. You'll be surprised what you're actually allergic to or may have an allergic aversion to, because there's a difference between having like something that you have like a shellfish reaction and your face blows up and you swell and you can't breathe versus having inflated white blood cells that are fighting antibodies in your blood system, in your bloodstream. That if you know more about yourself, you'll be surprised how quickly you can auto-correct yourself and have it done on your children too, which is very important, right? So I had one done last November, and I am incredibly gluten intolerant, right? So no pasta for me, right? But that explains why I would just feel exhausted all of the time, right? Because it's the glycemic spike, right, that genetically modified wheat creates in your bloodstream, right, for a lot of people. And it's like peanut allergies in kids, right? It's not the kids, it's the peanuts, right? So a lot of people are becoming intolerant to this, and a lot of people aren't even aware they're intolerant of it, right? My 7-year-old son, Hayden, right, we had a full panel spectrum blood work for him pulled, and he as well is wildly gluten intolerant, right? And we took him off of it, and his reading climbed 2 grades in a year, right? He started sleeping better, no more nightmares, and the dark circles under his eyes went away in 3 months, right? And he's a different human being, right? So I would say get to know yourself a little better by having a very extent, like really good blood work done, right? And if your doctor doesn't know what you're talking about, get a new doctor, and don't eat so much sugar. That's what I would do.
This is one of my favorite questions we've gotten. You put a lot of salt on your dishes. Do you eat that much salt?
You know, like so, sometimes when I'm cooking, because like I think if you like chocolate, you got like running shoes, right? I mean, it's just sort of everything's got like a pendulum swing, and to me, I think salt is, you know, I don't necessarily know, like, if you have a healthy lifestyle, I would rather tell you to stop eating sugar than stop eating salt, right? Because like salt, sugar is the first thing that's going to give you diabetes. Salt, no, it's not necessarily going to, right? It's but once you have diabetes, you have to kind of watch your salt consumption, right? But if your doctor tells you to stop, don't eat so much salt, please don't, right? But the thing about when people like are cooking something and they can't understand why it doesn't taste delicious, right? They're like, okay, let's put some salt in, and they'll pick up the tiniest scant amount of salt and drop it in and look at it, right? And then stir it in and go like, oh, it still doesn't taste good, right? And you go, okay, boom, right? And you throw it in like a chef, right? And then also think through like how your palate really wants to enjoy it. Like Eric and I just blended olive oil for a new project we're working on. It's gonna be out in the fall. And like I feel like just because of what I do for a living, my palate's really refined. But if you really just quiet your mind and listen to what you're tasting, your palate will tell you exactly what's not there, right? So your palate likes spicy, sour, salty, and sweet, and it really likes it in combination. That's the reason Thai food tastes great, right? Because it's like it's sour and it's sweet and it's like spicy and everything, right? So if you can get that kind of harmonious balance with food, it's not just about salt necessarily. It's about lemon juice, right? Right? So there's a big bowl of lemons in my fridge, right? I mean, not a fridge, but on my counter, right? And then when you're seasoning something, that you could hit a sodium ceiling, right? Like, okay, it's got enough salt in it, but still tastes flat, right? Because what it really needs is an acid balance, Or what it really needs is some sort of sugar, something to balance the whole thing out, right? Or it could use a little bit of pepper, or it could use a high note and a mid palate and a low note. So when you taste something that's a spectrum, it kind of looks like a bell curve, right? So it starts to climb, right? And then the first thing your palate will taste is whatever the subject matter is, right? Like a spaghetti sauce. I think spaghetti sauce is a good thing to sort of break down, right? Because you go, okay, wow, it's tomato, right? And then sometimes it'll just go, right? And that's it, right? But then the real skill, right, with someone, something's delicious, right, and they don't even know they're doing it, is to build that flavor spectrum higher and higher and higher. And then when you get past the initial subject matter of, okay, this is tomato sauce, there's a mid palate you have to address, right? And it's fat, right? It's olive oil, right? Viscosity, thickness, creaminess, right? And then the ceiling is where the good stuff is, right? And the ceiling is acid, right? The ceiling is complexity. It's fresh herbs. It's like these like top note nuances, right? And then when those things are in harmony, the long finish is about what we call cooking ghosts, right? Right? You know what I'm talking about? Like when you actually cook a ghost, right? And you can't stop thinking about it, right? Wow, right? The high definition, the art of creating a high definition channel between your tongue and your brain, right? Where you taste a thing and you go, Jesus, that is really good, right? That is what cooking is all about. And it goes so far beyond salt, right? So when people go like, I'm just putting a little bit of salt in it, boom. Right? Come on.
I think that's a great place to end it. I think... Thank you, Tyler.
Well, we saved you. Thank you, brother.
Thank you so much.
Oh, great.
That was awesome.
It was awesome. Yeah. Okay. Guys, thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I feel like I could chit chat all night. How about this? Let's take one question from the audience, because I know a lot of people ask questions. Anybody want to ask one question before we go? Go ahead, right here.
What would your last meal be?
What would my last meal be?
Good one.
Another annoying question. What was my last meal? Well, can I tell you I'm thankful that I grew up in such a rich area of the country, right, for cooking, right? I grew up in the American South. I grew up in South Carolina, right? And the food there is pure, right, and deep and interesting and historical. You can trace the trade winds. Most of it's African in history, right? And it's delicious and it's great. My Last Supper was a Melanie Dunay, right, wrote this really great book, and I was in the first version of it, and she actually hacked my piece up. I thought I wrote her a nice little story, and she turned it into questions. It was okay. But I feel like the last thing I'd want to taste is the first thing I ever really cut my teeth on, right? And that's just the beautiful food of the American South. That's my answer. Guys, thank you so much, right? Thank you. Thank you very much. Paul Lucchese, everybody. Thank you, guys.
So clearly, if everyone's enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley, I'd like again to thank Chef Cotter Florence, author of Inside the Test Kitchen, 120 Recipes Perfect. I'm Paolo Lucchesi, Inside Scoop columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, our audience here in Santa Clara, and for those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting is adjourned.